Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back. Or if you're new here, hi, my name's Georgia, and on my platforms here on the internet, I mostly focus on unsolved true crime. Today we're going to be talking about the case of Julie Doe, a woman who was discovered in the Green Swamp area of Claremont, Lake County, Florida in 1988. The remains were mummified and unrecognisable, but were very clearly that of a woman. She had long hair, manicured fingernails, and had undergone plastic surgeries in her lifetime, breast implants and a rhinoplasty, a nose job. Our autopsy pitting on her pelvis indicated that she'd given birth at least once. So in 1988, she's pegged by investigators as Jane Doe, and they go out in search of her name and her killer. The name Julie Doe be given to her many decades later. But then, in 2015, all preconceived notions of this case were thrown into question when authorities finally got funding to DNA test Julie Doe, and they discovered something that nobody expected. Instead of seeing XX chromosomes indicating a biological female, they saw XY, a biological male. It became clear in 2015 that Julie Doe was a transgender woman. Soon the DNA Doe Project took on Julie's case, and shortly after, the Trans Doe Task Force was conceived, when it became very clear that the Doe cases of transgender people required a bit of extra care. The identification of transgender people can be much more complicated than that of cisgender people. You don't know if families knew of the victim's identity, if they were rejected, if they were subject to violence in their life. Maybe their families chose not to come forward and identify them. Maybe they knew where they were the whole time. Maybe the unidentified person had a chosen family rather than a blood family. And then there's the fact that genetic genealogy will likely lead to a dead name, the name they were given at birth, but not the name they chose and lived by. Is that the name to end up on the gravestone? Having a non-profit that helps authorities navigate all these questions is invaluable. Reading directly from the Trans Doe Task Force website, transgender and gender variant people are disproportionately targeted in violent crimes and have a higher suicide rate. They are more likely to be estranged from their families or end up vulnerable without adequate support. There are likely to be hundreds of transgender Does filed in cold case files as either Jane or John, which may or may not match the gender they lived under or the descriptions anyone looking for them may have given. We will seek out and find these individuals who have slipped through the cracks so that they can have a chance of being identified using the latest advances in forensic science and technology. To this day, both the DNA Doe Project and the Trans Doe Task Force are working to try and identify Julie Doe. So let's see what we can do to try and help. Let's share her story from the very beginning. It was September 25th, 1988, when a person looking in the woods for cypress lumber came across a body just off of County Road 474 in Claremont, Florida, just north of the Lake Polk county line. The body was in 5-foot-high weeds, clearly hidden away. It wasn't very easy to spot. This area is known as Green Swamp, 560,000 acres of land between Tampa and Orlando, composed of wetlands, cypress swamps and floodplain swamps. It's a very hot and humid place with over 300 species of animals, and decomposition is often sped up under these kinds of conditions. It's estimated that Julie Doe had died 2 weeks to a month prior to being found, with Doe Network stating that the remains were both not recognisable and mummified. Only a very small amount of tissue remained on the body. Evidence at the scene pointed to the fact that Julie had been dragged off the roadway to the concealed area in which she was later found. And although no cause of death has ever been able to be determined, this has always been suspected as homicide because of this reason. She didn't drag herself off the road and end up in the weeds. Jane Doe was found wearing a greenish or sort of blue-green tank top, a long acid-wash denim skirt from the brand Manisha, and pantyhose that were partially rolled down, suggesting that she may have been sexually assaulted before or after her death. She had long hair that had been dyed strawberry blonde from her natural brown, and she had long manicured nails. She wasn't wearing any shoes, jewellery, or any other personal items. Nothing was found at the scene, and there's also nothing that could help aid in identification. Her body was transported to CAFIL, the CA Pound Human Identification Lab, where an autopsy was conducted by world-renowned pathologist Dr. William Maples. Maples worked on a number of high-profile cases throughout his career, but most notably, he worked on that of the Romanov family. In 1992, him and a team of colleagues headed to Russia to examine some remains that had been discovered, and the team confirmed that the remains were that of the Romanovs, minus Alexei and, of course, Anastasia. Of course, that is besides the point in this episode, but I thought it was fascinating to share. This was a world-renowned pathologist. Based on the mummified remains of Julie Doe, Dr. Maples determined that she was likely between 24 and 32 years old and around 5'10" tall. He described her as being strong with an athletic build and found that she had proportionally sized silicone breast implants. It was estimated that she got the implants before 1983, as this particular style of 250cc implant was discontinued that year. And in this time in the 80s, silicone implants did not have serial numbers on them, so that was kind of a dead end when it came to identification. The coroner's report also notes that one of the silicone implants had burst, although it's not said whether this was thought to be prior to death or sort of during the decomposition process. Although they obviously didn't know at the time back in 1988, Doe Network states now that Julie Doe was presumed to have undergone gender reassignment surgery around 1984 or prior. Language is constantly evolving in this area, and reading between the lines, I presume this is referring to what would now be called bottom surgery to reconstruct the genitalia. We can presume there was no evidence of male genitalia, otherwise Dr. Maples likely would have picked up on that at autopsy. Although, of course, it does say presume, decomposition was pretty advanced when she was found, and there was little flesh remaining on the body, so there's no way of knowing for sure if that's the case. There's also evidence of a rhinoplasty, so a nose job at some point, which may have been part of a sort of facial feminization surgery, or it may have been to fix a previous break, because it was very clear that Julie Doe had faced a huge amount of violence in her life, as is all too often the case with trans people. She had a possible healed fracture of anterior left seventh rib, a healed fracture of the right cheekbone presumed to be the result of blunt force trauma, a healed fracture to her right little toe, amongst many other healed injuries. Of course, at the time of the original autopsy, nobody was thinking about violence towards trans people or facial feminization surgery. It was just presumed that this was a biological woman who took pride in her appearance and had plastic surgery, but a woman who had also faced violence in her life. Dr. Maples would have examined the skeleton very carefully at autopsy, and he didn't see anything that made him doubt that this was that of a biological woman. There are morphological indicators that experts rely on to sort of accurately predict sex, with the main ones being the cranium and the pelvis, and here, Maples focused on the pelvis. The size and shape of a pelvis are usually a very good indicator of sex, but of course, bodies vary, no two are the same, and there are always anatomical variations. Maples noted many pits and ridges along the pelvic bone, which in 1988 were believed to have been caused by hormone changes during pregnancy, hormones that softened and widened the pelvis in preparation for childbirth. Nowadays, we know the same can be seen in biological males, and it can be caused by just regular hormone changes, such as undergoing hormone replacement therapy. Maples also noted at autopsy that the majority of tissue in the neck was absent, and there was damage to the hyoid bone in the neck, which sort of sits just above the Adam's apple. Now, this could perhaps suggest targeted violence in the area, or it could suggest further surgery in this area. This is all speculation, of course, because of the level of decomposition, but maybe she had surgery to have her Adam's apple sort of shaved down. I think in this case and other cases like it, you do have to sort of bear in mind natural bias. In the 1980s, the vast majority of people would have been very ignorant to transgender people existing. Or maybe they would have known about the existence of transgender people, but it wouldn't necessarily be acknowledged or at the forefront of anyone's mind, especially straight people. You wouldn't have really thought about it. Very few coroners in the 80s would look at a body which visually seems to be female, with breasts, long hair, nails, and a lack of male genitalia, and question that. In fact, there's probably very few coroners today who would do that. But today we have easily accessible DNA testing that can provide those kinds of answers. Back in 1988, this kind of testing was in its infancy and would have cost a lot of money, something that was out of reach to most law enforcement agencies. So you just sort of had to take things at face value. It's also probably worth here pointing out the existence of intersex people as well. Whilst the fact that Julie Doe did have XY chromosomes is known, further testing within that has not either been done or been released to the public. It's always been assumed that she was male to female transgender, and it's kind of as simple as that. But it could be that she fell under the umbrella of intersex. Not that it really would have made much difference in this time with the lack of understanding and lack of knowledge around it, but it could be important to point out. In the case of being intersex, external and internal genitals may be ambiguous, malformed, or entirely absent. We don't know if this is the case or not in Julie Doe's case, but it could be worth bearing in mind as no genitals are really spoken about in the report, whether internal or external. Many people have brought up the fact that surely Maples would have noticed a lack of uterus, ovaries, etc. And from sources, I think he did, but he likely put it down to the level of decomposition. I mean, I'm sure that animals did their thing on the remains in the weeks that she was in the swamp. She was very, very decomposed. But if she was intersex, that could be an identifying characteristic, so it is worth mentioning. Back in 1988, Julie's case was circulated. A forensic sketch was made and placed in all the local papers. They shared Julie's story, but no one ever came forward with an identity. And it wasn't long until the case just went cold and got put on the back burner. Investigators did speak with the nearest neighbour, but this area was so rural that he lived about a mile away from where Julie was found, and he didn't see or hear anything suspicious in the weeks before her death, or at least until her body was found. They also spoke with people at nearby businesses and bars, but again, this was a dead end. Local-ish residents did offer a number of potential leads as to who this woman could have been, but each time they're able to track the woman down and confirm that she was still alive, finding them safe and sound. It's always been suspected that Julie was murdered. This was a homicide. As I said earlier, she didn't place her own body in the weeds. But it has also been speculated that she may have been ditched after maybe overdosing on drugs and somebody just panicked and ditched her body. The level of decomposition when she was found meant that drug testing just couldn't be done. But then, 22 years later, in 2010, Florida was able to close two other old Doe cases on their books through DNA. Not genetic genealogy that wouldn't really rear its head for another few years, but through DNA testing. That very same year, Detective Tamara Dale took over the Lake County Sheriff's Office, and she made a push to solve cold cases, not just there, but statewide. The state as a whole got a whole load of funding to focus on these old cases, and in 2015, Julie's body was taken out of storage for DNA testing. She'd been kept at the lab since 1988 in an evidence room with a number of other unidentified people. By this point, Maples had passed almost two decades beforehand, so the person who took over the case was his mentee, Dr. Michael Warren, the current director of CAFIL. And when Warren looked over the remains, he noticed some anomalies, some things that didn't quite match up with Maples' analysis. But not really due to any fault of his own, Maples made his analysis simply based on the medical knowledge of the time, and a lot of things have changed since 1988. Warren noted the pits on the pelvis, which were previously speculated to be caused by a hormone that softens bones for childbirth. But this theory was discredited after women who had not given birth were found with them, and then it was found that men could secrete this hormone as well. In Julie's case, she would have been taking high amounts of estrogen. Warren said, "At the time, literature was starting to come out indicating these markings aren't a good indicator of childbirth or that a person is a female. Maples was a victim of the science at the time. All the reports called the person a female. If you're getting all the information, it can influence you. Plus, the person was wearing women's attire and had breast implants. The transgender community was much smaller back then, so it wasn't something you'd expect. fact. I do want to stress here that Julie Doe was a woman. You can't deny that. Looking at the entire body, she identified as a woman. She lived her life as a woman. However, when it comes to biologically, she was biologically male, and that is really important when it comes to identification. You have to know the full story. Warren said as soon as he looked at the remains, he suspected that it was that of a biological male. They ran all the measurements and statistics on the bones, and then the DNA confirmed what they suspected. It was true. Warren also found that the body was taller than originally noted. It was 5'11" instead of 5'10", and she could have been a year older, up to 33. Up until this point, Julie Doe had just been your bog standard Jane Doe, but forensic students working on the case in the lab felt it only fair to give her a unique name to distinguish her very unique circumstances. And so they turned to the 1995 cult classic queer movie, To Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, Julie Doe. To reflect all their new knowledge, forensic artist detective Stephen Fusco made a new reconstruction of her face. A couple of years later, in 2018, renowned artist Carl Kopperman also made a colour image. Now, of course, these images are approximations, but it's the closest they think they can get. A new investigation also took place, with investigators taking a look at local places that may have offered gender reassignment treatment in the 1980s. They looked at Miami, Atlanta, and New Orleans. She also may have travelled as far as California for her surgeries. It's around this point that Julie's case was taken on by the DNA Doe Project, and the medical examiner's office worked very, very closely with DDP on this. But despite two rounds of DNA extraction being funded, the extracts just didn't yield enough data to work with. But of course, they weren't going to give up. And then the TransDoe Task Force was conceived, beginning their efforts to help identify Julie Doe. They began to engage the public, but specifically the LGBT community, hoping that somebody in the community would hear the information and it would sort of catch their attention. They began to receive inquiries from the community about how they could donate towards a third round of DNA extraction, something which was very much still on the table at this point. Just because they'd failed twice didn't mean it was going to fail a third time. And opening the case up to the public led to a number of suggestions as to how to best identify Julie. One follower suggested that it could be helpful to have drawings to show what Julie may have looked like prior to transition, more male presenting. Although it's thought she'd began her transition many years prior to her death, loved ones may have not known her after that point. The TransDoe Task Force points out that while it may be unsettling to some to think about showing a trans woman looking like a young man, we must remember the purpose of forensic art is to reach those people who may remember the person from when they were alive, and that may be from any point in their life. By mid-November 2018, DNA Doe Project set up a fundraiser for Julie's case, and after a signal boost by the TransDoe Task Force, the case was more than funded within 48 hours. The overflow was going to go towards a fourth round of testing if it was needed, and if not, it would go towards the next transgender case that came across their desk. But that wouldn't happen because the third attempt also failed, but the fourth time worked in January 2020. Around this same time, isotope analysis of her bone, teeth and hair showed that she was likely from South Florida, spending most of her life in the Kissimmee River area, probably from sort of Polk County down to Monroe County. So Julie Doe was likely fairly local to where she was found. Today, her DNA has been entered into GEDmatch, where they have been able to make connections with very distant family members. You're talking third cousins mostly. The vast majority of us are not going to be familiar with our third cousins. So whilst genetic genealogists can sort of start working backwards through the family tree, it's a very slow and laborious process. They have thousands and thousands of potential family hits to sift through, and not all of them are going to pan out. There are so many branches of the family tree to look down here, like literally hundreds of them. It takes a really long time. As of the last update, they're not quite close enough yet to narrow in on a particular city or state to talk to relatives, but that's the point they're trying to reach. But the fact that Julie is trans is likely going to complicate things even more. We don't know her relationship with her family, if she was disowned, if they would even want to acknowledge her existence, if investigators came to them. We don't know if cousins, aunts, extended family members were told that she'd moved away, if she'd passed. If investigators came to them saying, "Do you have a missing family member?" they'd likely say no. In decades past, having a family member being a part of the LGBTQ+ community has been a source of great shame for so many. And if she is identified, would they even know Julie's chosen name? Would they acknowledge her chosen identity, who she really was? In 1988, trans individuals wouldn't have had official ID matching their gender expression or true identity. Julie's identification could just add a whole other layer of pain. As no missing individual from the region has ever matched her description, her disappearance is likely unreported. But as we have discovered doing this on the internet for many years now, there are lots of reasons why somebody might go unreported. Maybe family members tried to go to the police and they were brushed off, told an adult's allowed to run away. They don't need to keep in contact with you, and that was it. Something probably worth thinking about in Julie's case is that she likely had money or a means to get money to have the amount of reconstructive surgeries that she had. Was it family money? Did she have a well-paid job? If it were the latter, you would suspect somebody would have noticed that she was gone. But also, trans people finding jobs would have been a very hard task. We don't know how well Julie passed, but a passing individual would likely have a lot easier time getting a job than somebody who didn't pass. And I don't know why I'm talking in the past tense for this. That is still true for many trans individuals today. As many trans individuals had to do in this time and still today, there is a chance that Julie worked in sex work, and I do assume that is an investigative road that has been looked down. It could potentially explain her death, a pimp or a John who got violent. It could also explain the amount of money that she seemed to have. Gender affirming surgery is very, very expensive, it always has been, and Julie Doe seemed to have a lot of money to afford this. She was on hormones and had been for a long time. She had bleached and dyed hair. She had her nails done. She had money, somehow. There were only 6 clinics that treated gender dysphoria at this time in the United States, so investigators are following up leads with all of those. They're requesting that any physicians who treated patients with gender dysphoria in the late 1970s and early 80s, as well as anyone who transitioned or was in the trans community during this time frame, search their memories and/or records for Julie. She may have been in support groups. She likely was a figure in the Orlando LGBT community. She would have been around. People would have noticed that she'd gone missing. I mean, she likely had her chosen family, the people around her, who didn't want to go to the police when she disappeared because they knew they wouldn't be taken seriously. Statistics show that transgender people today are over 4 times more likely than cisgender people to experience violence, including rape, sexual assault, aggravated or simple assault. A study from the US in 2015 showed that nearly half, so 46% of transgender people, had reported being verbally harassed in the past year because of being transgender. Nearly 1 in 10, 9%, were physically attacked. 47% had been sexually assaulted at some point in their lifetime, and 10% in the last year. When it comes to trans people of colour, these numbers are even higher. 53% have been sexually assaulted in their lifetime and 13% in the last year. 72% of respondents had done sex work and 65% had experienced homelessness. More than half, at 54%, had experienced some form of intimate partner violence, including coercive control and physical harm. Whilst these numbers are awful now or in 2015, they would have been way worse in 1988. And that's only what's reported. Transgender people are way more likely to face violence in their lifetime than their cisgender counterparts. From the amount of healed injury she had and her potential murder, it seems like Julie Doe definitely fell under that umbrella. Julie's status on the DNA Doe Project website states that research is in progress and her DNA matches demonstrate ancestral ties to the southeastern United States. So far, that is all the information that we have publicly, but this is a case that is being actively worked. But for the full picture in this case, people in her community have to come forward with information. There had to be people in her orbit who could provide vital information as to her identity. Getting her birth name just isn't enough. Chances are her birth name isn't going to give us the full story. Chances are her family aren't going to be able to give the full story. We need people who knew her in life. If you have any information about this case, you can contact the Cold Case team or call Crimeline anonymously. I'll leave all their details in the description box, as always. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Thank you for choosing to spend this time with me and with Julie. Hopefully her identity is just around the corner. You've got the best of the best working on this case. The DNA Doe Project do incredible things, but I have a feeling that her identity is only going to be one piece of this very complex puzzle. I'll see you in the next one. Bye, guys.